Had I known that the enemy was going to use airplanes to kill on that fateful morning, I would have done everything in my power to protect the American people.
President Bush speaking yesterday, responding to questions that arose this week about intelligence reports that may have reached him before September 11th that warned of possible attacks in the United States by the Al-Qaeda terror network. Dan Schor is away this week, so joining us to review the week's news is Andrew Sullivan, senior editor at the New Republic magazine. And AndrewSullivan.com?
Yes.
.com. Okay. Andrew, good to have you back with us. To put it this bluntly, as such as we've been able to judge them this week, how persuasive do you think these warnings were that might have commended some action?
Not terribly. I mean, they don't seem to be different in kind from the kind of general warnings that were offered in 1999, in early 2000. They didn't seem to anticipate the specific actions of September 11th. Mm-hmm. However, they were there.
In which not only was a plane hijacked, but in fact was used as a weapon in and of itself. So it wasn't a matter of just a hijacking that ostensibly would be going to Cuba or
right.
Libya.
Nor was it a hijacking with guns, which is what everybody anticipated. It was a hijacking with box cutters that got through the metal detectors that were supposed to be our defense against this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I personally think that this is more a function of the fact that politics has been on hold for so long over the war that people, the Democrats particularly, are really frustrated in getting around this issue with the president. And suddenly partisanship has exploded rather like a pent-up force that has been held for so long. And there's a lot of emotion behind this. The Democrats have got to be careful, it seems to me. Bush was very persuasive yesterday and strong yesterday. And on this issue of the war, questioning his integrity on that matter, I think, could backfire if they're not careful. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we obviously do need to look and see what went wrong, how these agencies did not cooperate.
Mm-hmm. There was, we know now the FBI had a memo from their Phoenix field office that warning that there seemed to be an unusual number of Americans of Middle Eastern descent or Middle Eastern immigrants who were in flight school, wondered what was going on there.
Yes, and there was a warning in 1999 of the possibility of using planes to crash into buildings in Washington, which was mm-hmm. given to the Clinton administration. It seems to me that what we need to do is figure out exactly structurally how this happened, which means not engaging in whether Bush was responsible, Clinton was responsible, but looking how the system failed us instead of this partisanship. But the partisanship, you know, it's been held back for so long, and there's only so long that Washington can go without attacking the president in this kind of way. So I think that's what's behind it fundamentally.
Every time over the past few months, the government, Office of Homeland Security commonly, has issued some kind of alert. There are voices in the country that criticize them for being either imprecise or alarmist.
Well, they're kind of damned.
Do we need to look at our own reaction to them? I mean, what if they had issued warnings 8 months ago?
Right. I mean, they're kind of damned if they do and damned if they don't. And if they don't have specific intelligence about specific places, it's very hard to know what they do. Do they put the entire nation, you know, on freeze? Mm-hmm. Do they shut down every airport every other day? Inevitably, there's a trade-off here, and I think there's a certain element. I mean, the way in which the tabloids in New York have exploited this is really not very helpful. I mean, it's classic blame game material, and I think we need to get a little bit beyond that. And the public, frankly, I think, has grown up enough to know this is a bit of a Washington spat. And although the issues beneath it are necessary, some of this partisanship is really just Washington as usual.
Jimmy Carter, former president, visited Cuba this week. He said he saw himself no signs of the Cubans preparing biological warfare. He criticized the U.S. trade embargo, and he also encouraged Cuban dissidents who are trying to force their government to hold a referendum on reforms. Is it possible we're going to look back at this week as being the beginning of some kind of change in Cuba?
I'm not sure, Scott. I mean, I think that we've had that impulse many times before. I think the Pope's visit, for example, was regarded, in some ways, obviously was, a far more significant opening up. The question is really whether Castro is prepared to loosen his reins of power, and that's his decision, ultimately. But inevitably, also, this is the last holdout, mm-hmm. and at some point it's going to go, and everybody knows that. Mm-hmm. I hope this visit edges it one step forward. But we've been here so many times before that I forgive me for being a skeptic about the imminence of reform in that country.
Well, if not reform, what about the possibility that Cubans themselves might begin to try and take change in their own hands?
Well, I think plenty of them have. And they're in prison and camps and silenced. I don't think there's a lack of opposition in Cuba, but if you have a secret police and if you have a totalitarian system, inevitably your ability to oppose is severely restricted.
Let's ask about events in the Middle East this week. Ariel Sharon's own party says that it voted this week, the Likud party, refused to endorse the establishment of a Palestinian state. In your judgment, is this truly going to bind Ariel Sharon from reaching the kind of agreement that U.S. policymakers seem to want him to make?
Who knows, Scott? It's a depressing development. It seems to me any peace there is going to have to be based upon a two-state solution. It might be better to understand that in terms of Netanyahu's attempt to outmaneuver Sharon in his own party. But Sharon has a very strong support right now in Israel across parties. Mm-hmm. And in some ways you might see this, if he wanted to use it that way, which I'm not sure he does, as a good negotiating tactic. Look, mm-hmm. I'm being pushed by my people. I need to make a deal with you. And certainly on the other side, it seems that Arafat has his own problems as well. I mean, mm-hmm. he's got resistance in Jenin. He's got discontent among the Palestinians. I think that the end result of the Israeli incursion does seem to have been that some of the Palestinian terrorism has been reduced, that Arafat's own position seems weaker. So you have a little fluidity now, and if they're imaginative enough, they might be able to come to some sort of diplomatic initiative here. Of course, whether Arafat and Sharon will ever be able to make peace is another matter altogether. I'm personally, given their past histories, skeptical, but you never know.
Let me ask you about the results in the Dutch elections. Christian Democrats won 43 of 150 seats in the legislature. The late Pim Fortuyn's party took second place in national elections. If you separate out some of the distinct elements in the Pim Fortuyn platform, it's clear that Holland, which has often been considered the most predictably, if I might put it that way, left-wing government in Western Europe, is turning rightward. At the same time, there are other center-right governments that have gained power in Europe. What do you make of this?
Oh, I think it's seismic. I mean, I think, in fact, the U.S. press has actually underplayed this story. I mean, what's happening in Europe right now is very significant. There's a huge groundswell in many countries, from Spain to Italy, now to France. The polls are showing that the Conservatives may get a parliamentary majority in France, to buttress Chirac's victory, mm-hmm. To even the moribund Tories in England are showing some signs of life. There's a feeling amongst ordinary Europeans, clearly, that the European Union has taken away a lot of their autonomy, their national sovereignty, their sense that they have a say and a control over their own lives, and they are responding angrily to rather, I think, complacent European elites. And also the immigration problem is obviously the huge issue there. Mm-hmm. Whether this is understood as right...
Well, it's called a problem in a way we don't refer to it as a problem in North America, or at least not in respectable political circles.
Well, I think any... I mean, I think it's unfair to say that immigration is always easy. When you have a country as huge as the U.S. and so much space in it and so many mm-hmm. different people in it, then it's a different issue than when you have a very homogeneous country and a small, tiny, crowded one like Holland, absorbing a huge number, relatively speaking, of Islamic immigrants in particular, whose values are very alien to traditional Dutch values. I mean, you could see this as a liberal revolt. It's saying, look, gays and women and so on resent some of the Islamic propaganda.
Andrew, thanks very much.
You're very welcome, Scott.
Andrew Sullivan.